And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by LifeSpeed's Agile DC Executive Summit. Learn more at agiledcsummit.com.
This is Joshua Karajewski. You are listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest installation of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am very happy today to be talking with Brett Schrute about DevOps for legacy systems. So I'll be your host today. I'm Ryan Lockard, and Brett is a great resource for us to have on. He's currently one of the senior consultants for Industrial Logic, and he's led multiple large-scale Agile transformations in various fields in the past. He's a coach, a trainer. He's an author. He's worked with Bob Martin and the Clean Coder Project. So, Brett, welcome aboard. Did I miss anything? Is there anything that helps frame you out as a guest?
I think you got everything, though. I'm gonna correct you on the pronunciation of my name. It's Schuhart is how I pronounce it, or I think it's Schuhart if you're German, but I'm not really. However, I will say that was a new pronunciation. I've heard lots of them, and that was a good one. I like it.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't. So Josh Karajewski, also with Industrial Logic, when he was on, the running joke that I think he's got a little bit of an awareness to is one of my colleagues, Jay Herskow, who's got one of the hardest spelling last names in the history of names, butchered Josh's last name. And Josh is much more forgivable to butcher than I think Schuhart, so that's my bad. But anyway, we'll move on.
It's really quite all right. Actually, I think you've got a theme for this channel.
Yeah. So we're really good at learning quickly or failing quickly on this channel. So. All right. So legacy systems for DevOps. I'm sorry, DevOps for legacy systems. I think one thing that's really important to start with is when I talk about a legacy system, I know what I mean for myself. But when others talk about it, they mean something different. So for the sake of the next 35, 40 minutes, how would you frame out a legacy system? How would you set that up?
I would start with Michael Feather's definition, and so a system that doesn't have automated tests. I think in his actual book, he doesn't use the word automated, it's implied. So that's one thing. And the other qualifier is it's not legacy if it's not in use. So something that's in production that has some history of use, and you can't just change it willy-nilly. You have to respect how it currently works, even if you don't understand how it currently works. And if you do make a change, which is perfectly fine, to do, you need to do that eyes wide open. So a system in production that is either completely lacking some form of automated checking I'd go with that.
System and is in use.
It is in use. Because if it's not in use, you can change it, right?
Right.
And if it does have automated tests, you might be able to change it. It really depends on the tests. If they're reliable, if they can be run in a reasonable amount of time. And then it just gets down to what's your current cycle time and what's the risk of making changes. And then you need to take all that into consideration to allow you to decide how to move forward.
So is, given that definition, legacy system and legacy code are fairly irreplaceable, right?
I would say yes, though, when you add the word system in there, there's a lot more to it. I'll give you an example. The current system I'm about to work on, in fact, it's very relevant to this discussion, is a system that is in a lot of places. I won't mention the name right now, though maybe I'd come back and mention it, but I'd have to get permission first. But the underlying problem has 3,000 physical locations. At each location, there is one system that's running. That's sort of like a server for a number of clients, and then there's on average 30 clients, each its own machine, at these locations. So in reality, we have to deploy one application to 3,000 machines and then a different application to 70,000 machines. And the network includes satellite and in some cases actually at proper, you know, DSL, and a lot of cases it's mobile. And so that's the current problem I'm working on, taking an existing system written in C++ and trying to make improvements to its deployability as well as its migratability and updatability in a situation where these 70,000 sites are owned by 300 different organizations in the form of a franchise. And so you also have to take into consideration franchisees don't want changes unless because it might break things.
Right. So the description of that existing project is it's got my gear spinning. I'm trying to think, okay, what client could this be? What industry could this be? And then I move past that to there's a bit of parallel between what you're working on and what I've recently been working on. So that's exciting.
Cool. Very cool. It's food industry, by the way. So, I mean, I can tell you that much for sure.
Okay. All right. I was thinking that you were talking about something with the Apple stores until you said it was C++. So, defining legacy system is important, but also defining what we mean when we say DevOps. I think the emergence of the DevOps industry has really created variants on what that definition is. For the sake of our conversation, how do you frame DevOps?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question. So first of all, I want to go with Jez's definition. All right, it's not, you don't have a DevOps team. If you have a DevOps team, you're already cogricalting the idea. So it's the idea of bringing together all the individuals necessary to put something into production. So that might be security. It might be if you have a QA organization, it's certainly development. I like the model where the team is actually responsible for supporting it. So a team has the responsibility, capability, and accountability for developing something and putting it into production so that it is used by actual users. I would go with that. And when I say the team, I'm going to include, if we're using, say, traditional roles like a product owner, the product owner is part of the team. And when I say team, let's go even further. I want to say a cross-functional team. A cross-functional team is a durable group of individuals working, hopefully with a low amount of WIP, work in process, to get something in front of a user or users so that the user or user can be delighted. So that's sort of a loaded definition, but I think that's where I want to go with it. How's that sound for you?
Nice. Sounds good. And just for anyone that's not familiar, when you said Jez, you're referring to Jez Humble, right?
Yes. I actually don't know him, but yes.
Yeah, so Jez has published multiple times over. He's with Puppet, I believe, or with Chef. But anyway, he wrote Lean Enterprise and a couple other of the big DevOps books that are out there right now. Mm-hmm. So it's when you go for a definition, reaching for Michael Feathers for legacy systems and reaching for Jez Humble for DevOps, that's a really good place to start.
Well, I sort of pride myself in knowing the basics well and not much more than that. Because you know what? So many places I go, you consult and I consult. There's a natural sampling effect that happens when you consult. You go to places that need help. So given that worldview, most places don't do the basics well. And so if you get the basics well and people are in a situation where they are able to learn more, that's what you need. So because as an individual, I can't do it all, right? So, but what I can do is hopefully get people to the point where they can sort of self-serve themselves. And then in the end, it sort of is a self-fulfilling, you know, you get to critical mass and you get improvement over time by helping people to help themselves.
Yeah, at the risk of going too far off the track here, that is such a powerful statement that you just made. And that extends well beyond DevOps and technical consulting. That goes into all facets of just human learning. And I think that's great and agree 100% with what you said.
I'm heavily influenced by Jerry Weinberg's work.
Right. Yep. Perfect. So when we're dealing with a legacy system, which it's a system without high confidence is kind of how I look at legacy as well, to extend your definition a little bit more. When you're dealing with a legacy system and you're dealing with a new team that wants to gain some confidence, to wrap it into some DevOps services, What is the first thing you do? Where do you start to pull a lever to increase the confidence in that system and the deployability and the orchestration of it?
So it's it depends. I'll use the consulting answer. It depends on the context. So I'll give a current example. The current project I'm on, a couple years ago, I did an evaluation of some of the code they wrote, and I gave some recommendations. It was a C++ WAD. It's a big old single app thing. And I gave some recommendations. I even went back and showed them how to write some automated tests for the system. And it sort of fell on deaf ears. Nothing really happened. And so they brought us back again. And a friend of mine and I went through and did an evaluation of the entire code base. And this time we said, look, here's some recommendations for the code. But the problem is actually systemic. The problem is you're working with a bunch of component teams. And so you've got component issues. And also you've got a high amount of work in process. So it's really hard to get any kind of focus. And then also you change directions. So I look at really in a general sense, when I go into a project, I'm looking for three things. I'll give you my secrets. And this comes from Reinerstein's book, Principles of Product Development Flow. I look for handoff, cues. So for example, individual teams working together and having to coordinate. I look for work in process. How much have they got going on? Are they doing 17 things simultaneously or one or somewhere in between? And then batch size. How big are the things they're working on? And I look for those, and I look at how the code's impacting those three things, and I look at how the team working is impacting those three things. Or actually, I say team, but it could be just a bunch of groups. And then I try to figure out a path that's going to help make improvement. So that's a general answer to how I do things in general. Specifically in the DevOps world, then the first thing I'm going to look at is, can you build the system, right? How long does it take for me to get feedback about something I might have done? Because typically, that's a long time. If it's once every 6 months, you can't learn. As a human, it's very difficult to learn anything if the most frequently you can get feedback is 6 months. So I look at the things that are blocking feedback, and then I try to work on the things that, one, I have a chance of actually impacting, and two, will actually have an impact. And then for this particular thing that I'm working on, like I said, the team structure I think was more important than the code. You know, actually the C++ code, it's pretty well written. It's easy to follow. It's easy to maintain. And we could write more automated tests than currently exist, which is pretty low. But at the end of the day, if you don't change the structure of the environment that developed this solution, you're going to get the same thing. Even if you do a rewrite, which I'm almost never an advocate of a rewrite. I have done them, but I'm not a fan of big rewrites. That answer your question?
It does, but that's not what I expected you to say, which is interesting. And I just want to take a second and react to it, because I wasn't expecting a process answer. I was expecting something about understanding the architecture and breaking down the monolith into web services, or I expected to hear something about tests, but actually going back to flow and making my little lean heart smile, mm-hmm. and talking about the three-pronged approach to improving the process and improving the workflow itself is not what I was expecting. And I'm curious if I were to be speaking to Brett Shuhart 5 or 10 years ago, would the answer have been the same, you think?
Nope. I can tell you that for certain. It wouldn't have been the same. I would have been more focused on the code as opposed to the system. So
so I show my naivete in my thinking. Good.
No, well, you know, it's like now we'll digress again. I don't remember how I came across Principles of Product Development Flow, but if you haven't read that book, go read it. And you can get the first chapter for free, but just go read that book. It is a profound book, I think. So I'm gonna go into a deeper stack, then I'm gonna roll back. Out of college, I worked for a company that did manufacturing process stuff. And as a side effect of that, since they were in operations research, I read The Goal, right? Mm-hmm. Have you ever read The Goal? Are you familiar with the book?
I am familiar with the book.
Okay, yeah. And so The Goal is about a theory of constraints. Okay, so fast forward a decade. I, at some point, became aware of how profoundly that impacted my thinking of how to do things but I wasn't aware for a long time that it had. And then, since then I've read a lot of process books and all that kind of stuff. And then I came across Reinerstein. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. And my mental model of that book is it's a whole bunch of chapters. Each chapter has a whole bunch of principles, and they're all based on a simple idea. Get down to the idea of cost of delay, and then frame everything in that idea. And then depending on how you calculate that, it's going to have an impact. All right. So if you look at that book, I believe that you can, picking a subset of principles, come up with Scrum, come up with Lean, come up with XP, and all of the above. So it's like, for me, it's an overarching framework of principles that you can then use to apply to every situation. And out of that, there's a lot of stuff in there, but out of that, the three big things that continue to stick with me are batch size, work in process, and handoff or cues.
We actually did a show with David Anderson about two or three months ago, and obviously those topics were covered in depth. But I'll make sure I get a link to all the books that we just mentioned, as well as the Anderson podcast. And then Anderson has his Blue Book, so mm-hmm. the provenance of the thinking models that we just went through. Goal was published first, and then you had Reinerstein's Flow, I believe, and then shortly after the Blue Book came out. And then if you're in the manufacturing world, I would also throw out there the Phoenix Project. It's a really good, it's an extension of the Goal, basically, but it turns it into more of a novel format and makes the reading and it expresses WIP and expresses queuing in a very friendly format. So we can go down that rabbit hole for hours if you want.
The Reinerstein book, in terms of the complexity as you get through the book, it's exponential. And I'm sure I don't understand everything he's got in there, but I read it all, and every time I start a new gig, I try to get a book club to read it again, to get me motivated to read the whole thing again, but haven't been successful with that.
You just motivated me to dig up my copy, and if I can't find it, get another one and start it all over again. So So when I'm going to put the train back on the tracks here. What are some of the base practices? So assuming we establish a healthy cadence of flow, we have a respect for the WIP, for the constraints and the queuing and things of that nature. When we get into the practices, what are some of the base practices that should be understood within a team if we're looking to improve legacy code? I'm thinking things like test-driven development, refactoring, sure, pairing, solid principles. I know I just gave a bunch of answers, but is it in that vein, or yes,
those
are we
are
off
definitely
the mark?
Good things. But okay, so yes, and everything you just said. Let's go back to basically theory of constraints, or you look at Reinerstein's stuff. You look at the constraints. Instead of using theory of constraints, what is the most constrained? Add a lean twist on that and say, what is the constraint closest to the customer that's stopping us? So on my current project, their deployment process currently is, we're going to deploy to 1 to 5 stores at 2 o'clock in the morning. And if that works, then 24 hours later, we're going to do another 20 to 40 stores. And then 24 hours later, if that works, we're going to scale up. And then so the whole deployment process out to the entire world is 4 days when it's successful. Right?
So it's like it's a pseudo canary release.
Yeah, exactly. So what we told them, I was brought in, my friend Dave and I were brought in to say, hey, what can we do to fix this code? And our answer was actually, number one, fix how you write software. Number two, work on deployment. Because you can't make improvements to the code if you can't deploy. Deployment is a lot closer to the user than the code. And so working from the user backwards, what is the constraint that's constraining you the most? So deployment. We're going to do test automation. That's going to come. And we're going to start some of that. But in the spirit of low WIP, we're going to work on deployment first. And then we might work on building up some automated tests. And then we're going to look at replacing, using the strangler pattern, we're going to look at replacing some parts of the system, because the system as written is inherently sort of service oriented, it's a monolith of microservices. So there's new features that can be written in an entirely different technology stack that will allow us to work on a new tech stack, but we can't work on that if we can't deploy. So I think I answered your question, right? But yeah, pair programming, automated test, the XP practices are important, but also team practices are important. If you're on the cross-functional team, then you're dedicated to that backlog and not three other backlogs. So the team itself has low WIP, and then individuals which are part of the team are not, I mean, they're going to be distracted because you're in a large corporation, but we need to track that at first. And then if it becomes an issue, then we need to manage it. But first measure if there's distraction, and then manage it only if necessary.
All right. So then let me ask a similar but this different question. What is the impact of that approach if you have a distributed team?
Well, it's going to be slower, right? And now you're looking at how does Conway's Law impact the overall system? But to sort of dovetail back to something you mentioned earlier about, do you look at the architecture first? The architecture is a reflection of the team structure, and the team structure is a reflection of the organization. So
which is the synthesis of Conway's Law, if you're not familiar with Conway's Law.
So I'll mention something, a recent project that a bunch of us worked on. We were working in a different country. I'm not going to mention the country because there's small enough number of places that you could probably figure out what it was. Their cycle time was roughly 24 weeks. And so what we did was we did co-location, cross-functional teams, low WIP. That's all we did. Same number of people doing the work. The cycle time after a month and a half, we got it from, I'm going to give you several numbers, 24 weeks down to, I think it was either 6 or 4 weeks.
Okay.
Same amount of work, same people.
But,
right.
But you also expressed what the cycle time was. You made that metric known, I assume, right?
We did. The published numbers, I think, were actually 22 weeks down to 8 weeks, but it was actually better than that. And an interesting something I learned on that, by the way, and in retrospect, it's obvious, but for some reason, I just didn't think about it. They thought their cycle time was much better than it was. And so when we were actually being seen as a failure. But when I went back and looked at the actual numbers, I said, look, actually, if you look at these numbers, the cycle time you calculated is not correct. It's actually 24 weeks. And our resulting cycle time is actually much better than we thought. So one, actually measure cycle time. And two, don't believe that the provided measure of cycle time is an accurate reflection of reality.
In that organization, did they put their eyes towards lead time at all, or was the focus purely on cycle time?
They were actually looking at both, but they were trying to get they were just trying to get stuff done. And what they had was, on average, everybody had 13 things they were working on.
So then managing WIP, I should say, was that the biggest impact to reduction of 24 weeks down to 8 or 6?
I think I think to enable management of WIP, co-location was necessary because the teams were physically separated and the teams were it was very easy to be distracted. So now to go back to unwind the stack. Because the original question was, well, how do you deal with non-co-located teams? And each situation is different. If it happens that you can actually work on features with different teams, which seldom happens, that's great. I'm not very good at doing it myself, but what I do like to do is, and what we're doing for this current project is, we're going to co-locate for a couple of weeks. And then once we've co-located, then we'll hopefully learn how to work together. Right. On another gig where I was just helping sort of give people ideas, there was going to be co-location and there was going to be a 2 or 3 week period of co-location. And the first week was sort of how are we going to work and so on. But then we were going to start to practice co-location so that by the time we weren't trying to figure out co-location while we were remote. Another thing is if you have co-location, treat everybody as co-located as opposed to forming cliques. The cost of having you know, a bunch of people together working closely is that, you know, they're going to work together, but you're going to form specialization, and specialization ultimately hurts flow. So you need to consider, is flow more important than local optimization? Because, you know, in principle, local optimization leads to global disoptimization, right?
Right. Well, it's one of the classic forms of waste. So yeah.
Exactly. So
I think it wasn't until you started talking here that I came to the realization that, say, you have a distributed team that you then co-locate, mm-hmm. you do not have the same team because the context shifted.
No.
Once you bring those people into a unified system, you have a new team, even if the membership did not change.
Totally agree. And in fact, that's the reason. Okay, so with this other gig, the co-location thing was somewhat controversial. And what we ended up doing is we came up with a list of, I don't remember, it was like 7 or 8 things that were required to start. And one of the things was co-location. And we actually delayed the start because they were not sure if they were going to do it. And in my mind, I was willing to walk away from that engagement because the environment was so toxic that I thought co-location was absolutely necessary to have any chance of success. And I think in that situation, it was correct. I think in my current situation, we've got people that are physically living in different locations. I think co-location is a reality, but I think it's going to be okay because the people, even though they're on component teams, are still working together. And so really what we're going to do is we're going to take some practices that are working for them, like they talk to each other, and just make sure they do it better or more.
Right. Right. So then I guess the other piece that kind of comes into mind, and we did a good number of a good bit of conversation around the mindset required at the team level. When we talk about mm-hmm. infrastructure as code, when we talk about DevOps, when we talk about establishing flow with a system, when we are entering a new engagement where we're looking to make DevOps or infrastructure as code as a practice, what is the impact to the management tier and then one level above that at the leadership tier? To what level do we need their buy-in, their engagement, and what should that level be aware of as an organization starts applying this mindset?
So if you just want to consult and make money, you don't need any engagement with them at all. If you want to have any kind of reasonable chance of success, then you need their engagement. And so then the question is, how soon do you decide to walk away if you don't have their engagement? So we could, for example, go in and have some local success and build up on that. And that's through accretion, you build trust with upper management. I know some people, like, for example, Craig Larman, who I have a lot of respect for, he'll take, if you've got like hundreds of people, he'll say, I want a team of 50. It has to be big enough that the team can be successful. And then he will get the 50 people together and work on them and cross train, you know, get rid of the idea of specialization and so on. And in his case, if management isn't willing to do that, then he'll walk away. So, I'm not suggesting whether you should or shouldn't walk away, but what I'm saying is it has to eventually happen. And I'm reminded of a picture I saw someone post on Twitter years ago, but imagine a huge, like a graph, like a huge, it's not a binary tree, but imagine a binary tree, like an org chart structure. And then way at the bottom is one that's circled and colored and say, hey, we're going to go agile, right? That team will be efficient. But if that team is part of an overall system that's not delivering, fixing that individual team is not going to have an impact. And in fact, for the project I just mentioned where I was out of the country, 22 to 8 weeks or 24 to 4 weeks, depending how you measure it, it's pretty good. The biggest challenge, though, is that business was a separate reporting unit, and business was still throwing more stuff than that could possibly be handled to the team. And so as a result, there was a lot of waste looking at things that would never be done or wouldn't be done for 6 months. And since they wouldn't be done for 6 months, the context would change so much that it was a bunch of waste. And so the next challenge was, we've got to get business involved in also controlling the amount of WIP coming in. So you need to really have everywhere from the creation of ideas to the support of running systems involved if you want to eventually have real flow across the system. And so then if you have a chance of doing that, you can build it up from the bottom or down from the top, or best of both worlds, build from both directions. My current gig, I've got the C-level people involved and they brought us in, and I've got the team people involved and we're working towards the middle, and I think that's going to be real successful.
I completely agree with everything you said. And, you know, it's interesting how deep we went into lean on this show. But the last 2 days, I was actually conducting some lean training inside the company I'm with. And what you're talking about with... So one of the principles of lean is that you optimize the entire system, the whole system. We don't like creating optimized silos or localized success, and making sure that you have not just the business, because when we say business, we typically mean product management, but the entire business. If we are going to actually be successful in what we're doing, if it be that DevOps, be that process, be that coding, we are going to start delivering things at a scalably faster process than cadence than we ever have in the past. So if you don't have your marketing engaged, marketing then becomes a technical release blocker or hindrance. If you don't have sales engaged, same thing. If you don't have accounts receivable, because if we're actually going to start shipping more features quickly, we need to make sure that our accounts receivable system is set up so that we can bill faster, or that we can set up billable items in the system faster. So I love that answer, and I agree. If you are trying to be that internal change agent and all you're trying to do is optimize your team, you will see local success, but you will not see that scalable success that makes companies win
in
the industry.
I had an interesting experience 2 years ago. I was brought in for like a 6-week coaching gig. They wanted to go to Scrum. And I've done that a couple times where people successfully went to Scrum or some version of Kanban or whatever. But in this particular case, you know, I was working with the developers, and then at some point I got to the C-level people, and the C-level people had already had this internal list, and what they were saying was, this is a list of things we think we can get done for the end of the year. And as new stuff came in, they asked the question, is this more important than the stuff that's on this list? So they were too far out in the future, I think, in terms of their priority, but they had the right mindset. We have to limit the flow of ideas. So every idea has to be considered against these other ideas. Are they more important? And if the answer is no, we don't even consider them. If the answer is yes, what goes out? And so that group actually, the developers loved going to, actually we went in that case, we started with Scrum, but went to Kanban. It made more sense for them. I think it makes more sense in general, but that's a whole other discussion. But the management was thinking the right way, and the developers had to sort of get off high whip, because that high whip is actually can be really intoxicating. You're always active, but not getting anything done, and you don't have to get anything done. So learning to work with focus takes personal change at the individual level, at all levels of the organization. But they were successful. They had just enough of the right things in place that over time, I mean, I called them a year and a half later and they were still going strong and things were doing great. And and the C-level people had moved the time frame that they were looking further closer. So they weren't like saying, well, what's the next year of stuff? It's more like, what's the next quarter? So they had vision, but in terms of project priorities, they were trying to look at things. Their portfolio, they're trying to manage a shorter time window, which is great.
So when we wrap that lean training that I was taught, and I'm tying this back into what you literally just said, when we wrap that lean training yesterday afternoon right here in beautiful Philadelphia, we made a personal commitment to ourselves that we're no longer going to be able to accept the status quo. What's been done in the past is no longer acceptable. We're committing to ourselves and we're committing to our team that we're going to challenge the status quo and that we're going to start improving. And when we think we've improved, we're going to improve again. So I agree with everything you just said. You need to make a commitment to yourself and to your team to make things better. And I'm also smiling at this desk I'm sitting at right now because we're probably closing the show in the near future. And we haven't yet talked a single word about tools or about the big cloud providers, either AWS, Azure, or other. And we're having a show on DevOps. And I kind of find that ironic, and I'm kind of happy about that. So I'm curious, to what degree do tools and providers play when you go into an engagement?
Ooh, I'm pausing because I'm trying to think. And I don't want to reply in a snarky way.
I was setting you up for snark. I was giving you a snark on a T.
Well, remember my initials are BS, so you know I'm all, anyway. Let me digress. So let me say, as a consultant, I've been consulting for many, many years. I'm not saying I'm a good consultant, but it's what I've been doing. And part of that is my attention span is such that I get bored if I'm not doing interesting or new things after 6 months, right? So that's why consulting sort of suits my personality. But I mention that because a lot of times tools are not really in my purview. So I'll go in and talk about things, but I try to generally stay tool agnostic. I do like tools like I love cards. I love tape. So I love low tech. And so I like to actually start by doing things without tools initially and then eventually work into tools. In a lot of cases, you have constraints and environments. And so, you know, if you're playing the long game, initially you go with what's going on and then you try to move people off some of the tools. But to specifically mention, if you're going to do stuff with the cloud, then do stuff with the cloud. But at the end of the day, you actually said this, I want my infrastructure. I want code as infrastructure as code. I want things repeatable. And if you work on making things work, and then once you've got them working, then automating them and using good practices. You know, I've used Puppet and I've used Chef and I've used a few other tools. The one thing I'm very weak at is test-driven infrastructure. So I will do it, but I'm not very good at that. I would love to work with somebody who's, in fact, I've got another friend named Ryan who does that kind of stuff. And I would love to get a chance to rub shoulders with him to learn how to do that. But you need to treat that stuff. It's part of the system. So earlier you asked, do you work on the code? Do you work on the system? When we talk about the system is the corporate environment and also the mentality and the approach you use at developing all the pieces that are required to put something into production. So if you write your system well, the underlying tools are important, but less important. You're currently doing stuff in an environment where private information is important. Can you go into the cloud easily?
The answer is yes and no. We can go into the cloud easily. No, I mean, so yes, I work in the healthcare market. So right. We have basic PII. We have right. Some PCI. And mm-hmm. Wow, I'm really going to do the acronyms here, but we also have some HIPAA concerns. Yeah, right. So right. we have PII, we have PCI, we have HIPAA. And once you start then going into different geos, when you go into Europe or if you go into Canada, there's also additional governmental privacy acts that we have to be adherent to.
Exactly.
Yeah, so the answer is yes. We can get into the cloud. We can go from iron to cloud quickly, but then you have to handle all the security ops. And some of the cloud providers are a little bit more graceful to that than others.
Right. And so that's something you would need to take into consideration. I've been in a lot of cases where, my current situation, they're doing a lot of their new work. They're doing some mobile stuff, and the mobile stuff is pretty interesting, and the mobile stuff is in the cloud. But they have a point of personalized experience where you drive up and you see a computer. Now, right now, there's a computer there. I can imagine that computer being completely gone. And in 5 years, it's in your car, it's on your phone, and the computer's gone. But right now, that's there. Going to the cloud doesn't do any good because a lot of those places have satellite radio availability. And so you've got bandwidth limitations. So in my current gig, not going into the cloud. But last gig, they were actually moving into Pivotal. And I've dabbled in AWS. I've done a little bit more in Pivotal and so on. I think they're interesting, but I mean, if I'm going to do anything cloud related, first thing I'm going to do is make sure everyone agrees 12-factor.net, right? So let's agree to some approaches that make sense so that the thing we write is actually meant to be in the cloud. And then we have to also bring in the constraints of PI and so on. And you mentioned, geolocations. I've worked a couple times. I actually lived in England and in Ireland. And so every time someone starts talking about things like personal information or credit cards, I think, oh, how quaint. We're in the US. We really don't care about that stuff.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We say we do, but it's security theater, but compared to Europe.
Yeah. And that is a whole nother layer of complexity, because you have the European laws, and within on top of the European laws, you may have variant laws within each of the different countries, and they're fairly dynamic. So it's it's Y2K on steroids, basically.
Yeah. So I'm going to put a little bit of a political spin in there, so people who listen to this can figure out sort of where I stand. In Europe, they still at least pretend to care about individuals. whereas in the U.S., corporations have ruled for years, and it's just become a lot more obvious in recent years.
So you think that you made it a riddle to figure out where you stand?
No. In fact, I just pretty much stated where I stood for anyone listening. Though anyone who's ever read anything that I put on Facebook or Twitter can pretty much figure out where I sit.
So that said, I think we're cruising to a close here. You mentioned Facebook and Twitter. What is the best way for people to get a hold of you, Brett?
Well, Twitter is probably the best. S-C-H-U-C-H-E-R-T. That's just me. So I've been on Twitter long enough that it's just my last name. But you can get if you're interested in getting a hold of me, you can certainly get a hold of me at Industrial Logic. I'm Brett, B-R-E-T-T, at industriallogic.com. And I still use my Yahoo account, and the reason I use my Yahoo account is I've had it since '96, I think, and so it's my last name at yahoo.com. I wish it was literally my last name, but it's actually Shuhart at yahoo.com, and so those are the places to get a hold of me.
Yeah, great. And I'll make sure I get all that into the show notes so that it's nice and easily clickable for any of the listeners. Just to wrap up, I'm Ryan Lockard. You can find me at AgilePHL on Twitter. And I'm all over the Agile Uprising Coalition, the blog. I have a couple articles on our blog. But please give Agile Uprising a follow on Twitter. It's just at Agile Uprising. If you like this show, please take a listen to some of the others in the past and give us a follow on the on either iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcasting channel. And also, please give us a review. We want to hear back from you guys. Let us know on the podcast itself if you're listening and if you're liking it. And if there's something we can do to improve, we are always open to that feedback. So one final thank you, Brett. I appreciate you coming on, sir. It was a wonderful pleasure to talk with you.
You're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity. I love talking about this stuff. This is, when I talked about chatting with my friends years ago, this is the kind of stuff we used to do for hours every night when I was, single. This is a private conversation between you and I, but I just love talking about this kind of stuff, just sort of being social and talking about geeky stuff. So thank you for the opportunity.
It comes through, and it's genuine. You can hear it in your voice. You can hear it in the cadence. So, the listeners and I thank you for coming on and giving us your perspective.
Excellent. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Agile Leaders in the DC Metro. Live Speed's Agile DC Executive Summit is September 13th. The annual conference hosts DC's top lean and agile industry leaders and executives from private and public sectors. Join top-rated speakers in exploring agile digital transformation, and be one of the first 50 people to register for $100 off the ticket price at agiledcsummit.com. LitheSpeed helps you make your work more productive, fulfilling, and valued. Ask about training, coaching, and consultation today.